Welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. This is episode 30, Lessons of the Cold War, with our very special guest, Peter Robinson. I'm your host, Alan Woolen.
Follow the Moskwa down to Gorky Park, listening to the wind of change. August summer night, soldiers passing by, listening to the wind of change.
The song you are hearing is called Wind of Change, and it was written and performed by the German rock band Scorpions in 1990, just a few months after the fall of the Berlin Wall. It's hard to overstate the impact this song had on the popular zeitgeist at the time. Wind of Change was an immediate worldwide sensation, coming in at number one in Germany and across Europe, number two in Great Britain, and number four in the United States. This song is not only the best-selling single ever by a German artist, it is also one of the best-selling singles of all time, with over 14 million copies sold worldwide. Just last month, the official YouTube video passed over 1 billion views. Yes, 1 billion views. But the significance of this song is much deeper than the fact that it's a great song, which it is. The song tapped into one of the most momentous social and political shifts in human history. The song expressed the hopes and dreams of four generations of people around the world that the Cold War was coming to an end, that the Iron Curtain, which had descended across Europe at the end of World War II, was being dismantled, and that the lives of hundreds of millions of people were going to be changed forever. The world is closing in, and did you ever think that we could be so close, like brothers? The future's in the air. I can feel it everywhere. I'm blowing with the wind of change.
The world is closing in. Did you ever think that we could be so close, like brothers? The future's in the air. Can feel it everywhere. I'm blowing with the wind of change.
Klaus Meine wrote those lyrics right after the Scorpions had performed at the Moscow Music Peace Festival in August of 1989, just 3 months before the fall of the Berlin Wall. What a time to be alive. What a time to be so close to so many positive developments which would change the course of human history forever. The future's in the air. I can feel it everywhere. How right he was. There are some moments in life where you just stop and realize that the future isn't what it used to be. This episode is specifically about the Cold War and the lessons of that war. But the episode really goes beyond just the Cold War to look at the entire history of the 20th century and what we can learn from it. In one of his best quotes ever, Sowell said this about the 20th century, quote, "The history of the 20th century is full of examples of countries that set out to redistribute wealth and ended up redistributing poverty." But what exactly was Sowell talking about here? For some of you, this quote might be very clear, and a light bulb goes off in your brain when you hear it. For others, the quote might seem somewhat cryptic, and you just kind of hear it and scratch your head and say, tell me more. I'm not a historian. I'm just a regular guy. But I'd like to tell my version of the story of the Cold War, because what I think about that history really matters. What you think matters too. After all, if we don't know the history, how are we supposed to learn from it? I believe that what everyday people think about our history is even more important than what our smartest intellectuals and historians think about history. Why? because everyday people vote every day. So what we think about the past, individually and collectively, really matters. To open this episode, I chose a song by a German band. That was no coincidence. I chose a German band because I want to talk about the city of Berlin, in particular, about the Berlin Wall. For me, the Berlin Wall was and still is the most powerful symbol in human history. Every high school and college student should be taught a semester-long class about the history of the Berlin Wall. It's that important. Ever since I started reading Ayn Rand back in high school, I was interested in the struggle between individualism, on the one hand, and what Rand called statism or collectivism, on the other hand. Rand was the individualist's individual, and she opposed all forms of collectivism on a visceral level. Ayn Rand said this, quote, "We are fast approaching the stage of the ultimate inversion, the stage where the government is free to do anything it pleases, while the citizens may act only by permission, which is the stage of the darkest periods of human history, the stage of rule by brute force." End quote. Is it just me who gets the chills from just about every Ayn Rand quote? I gobbled up everything Ayn Rand ever wrote, and I even started an objectivist club at college to get together with other Rand fans to talk about her work. Kind of like what I'm doing now with Sowell and this podcast. Maybe I just have a groupie personality. Hey, when I'm enthusiastic about something, I go all in. That's not a bad thing, is it? I majored in intellectual history when I was at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was lucky enough to study under the great Dr. Alan Coors, who introduced me to the most important thinkers in history. Throughout my college years, I remained fascinated by what Sowell calls the conflict of visions. Socialism and its first cousin communism on the one side, against capitalism on the other. This struggle took concrete form in the so-called Cold War, the constant and simmering competition between the United States and her allies and the Soviet Union and her allies. When I was a kid, I grew up under the ever-present fear that the Cold War could, at any minute, turn into a hot or actual war. Today, in schools, they practice active shooter drills to keep the youngsters on edge. When I was a kid, we practiced atomic bomb drills, and we were told to hide under our school desks whenever a certain shrill alarm went off over the school PA system, as if ducking under a desk could possibly protect you from an atom bomb. What were they even thinking? That was my generation's biggest fear, and I remember always keeping water bottles behind my bed just in case the big one came and it knocked out the plumbing. Today, they keep the kids on edge about lunatics with guns and invisible viruses, not to mention apocalyptic visions of climate catastrophe. Geez, can't they just let them have a childhood feeling safe and secure? I guess that would be too much to ask.
How dare you?
Well, at least now you know why my wife and I homeschool our kids. On October 22, 1962, just 1 month before I was born, President John F. Kennedy gave an 18-minute speech in which he informed the American public and the whole world that the Soviet Union was installing nuclear-armed missiles just 90 miles from Florida and that the United States was immediately executing a naval blockade of Cuba. Both the content as well as the tone of Kennedy's speech made it clear to all Americans that the Cold War with the Soviets could turn hot at any moment, and that humanity was on the brink of World War III. Here are some highlights from that speech.
On October 22, 1962, President John F. Kennedy broadcast a special message to the nation from his office in the White House. Here is President Kennedy as he delivered that message, bearing on recent events in Cuba.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. And having now confirmed and completed our evaluation of the evidence and our decision on a course of action, this government feels obliged to report this new crisis to you in fullest detail. The characteristic of these new missile sites indicate two distinct types of installations. Several of them include medium-range ballistic missiles capable of carrying a nuclear warhead for a distance of more than 1,000 nautical miles. Each of these missiles, in short, is capable of striking Washington, D.C., the Panama Canal, Cape Canaveral, Mexico City, or any other city in the southeastern part of the United States, in Central America, or in the Caribbean area. Additional sites not yet completed appear to be designed for intermediate-range ballistic missiles, capable of traveling more than twice as far, and thus capable of striking most of the major cities in the Western Hemisphere, ranging as far north as Hudson's Bay, Canada, and as far south as Lima, Peru. In addition, jet bombers, capable of carrying nuclear weapons, are now being uncrated and assembled in Cuba, while the necessary air bases are being prepared. This urgent transformation of Cuba into an important strategic base by the presence of these large, long-range, and clearly offensive weapons of sudden mass destruction constitutes an explicit threat to the peace and security of all the Americas. Neither the United States of America nor the world community of nations can tolerate deliberate deception and offensive threats on the part of any nation, large or small. We no longer live in a world where only the actual firing of weapons represents a sufficient challenge to a nation's security to constitute maximum peril. Nuclear weapons are so destructive, and ballistic missiles are so swift, that any substantially increased possibility of their use or any sudden change in their deployment may well be regarded as a definite threat to peace. Nevertheless, American citizens have become adjusted to living daily on the bullseye of Soviet missiles located inside the USSR or in submarines. In that sense, missiles in Cuba add to an already clear and present danger. Although it should be noted, the nations of Latin America have never previously been subjected to a potential nuclear threat. But this secret, swift, extraordinary buildup of communist missiles in an area well known to have a special and historical relationship to the United States and the nations of the Western Hemisphere, in violation of Soviet assurances and in defiance of American and hemispheric policy, this sudden, clandestine decision to station strategic weapons for the first time outside of Soviet soil is a deliberately provocative and unjustified change in the status quo, which cannot be accepted by this country if our courage and our commitments are ever to be trusted again by either friend or foe. But now further action is required, and it is underway, and these actions may only be the beginning. We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced. Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. This quarantine will be extended, if needed, to other types of cargo and carriers. We are not at this time, however, denying the necessities of life, as the Soviets attempted to do in their Berlin blockade of 1948. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventualities. And I trust that in the interest of both the Cuban people and the Soviet technicians at the sites, the hazards to all concerned of continuing this threat will be recognized. It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. As a necessary military precaution, I have reinforced our base at Guantanamo, evacuated today the dependents of our personnel there, and ordered additional military units to be on a standby alert basis. We are asking tonight that an emergency meeting of the Security Council be convoked without delay to take action against this latest Soviet threat to world peace. I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and to stable relations between our two nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race and to transform the history of man. He has an opportunity now to move the world back from the abyss of destruction. We have no wish to war with the Soviet Union, for we are a peaceful people who desire to live in peace with all other peoples. But it is difficult to settle or even discuss these problems in an atmosphere of intimidation. That is why this latest Soviet threat, or any other threat, which is made either independently or in response to our actions this week, must and will be met with determination. Any hostile move anywhere in the world against the safety and freedom of peoples to whom we are committed, including in particular the brave people of West Berlin, will be met by whatever action is needed. Many times in the past, the Cuban people have risen to throw out tyrants who destroyed their liberty. And I have no doubt that most Cubans today look forward to the time when they will be truly free, free from foreign domination, free to choose their own leaders, free to select their own system, free to own their own land, free to speak and write and worship without fear or degradation. And then shall Cuba be welcomed back to the society of free nations and to the associations of this hemisphere. My fellow citizens, let no one doubt that this is a difficult and dangerous effort on which we have set out. No one can foresee precisely what course it will take or what costs or casualties will be incurred. Many months of sacrifice and self-discipline lie ahead, months in which both our patience and our will be tested, months in which many threats and denunciations will keep us aware of our dangers. But the greatest danger of all would be to do nothing. The path we have chosen for the present is full of hazards, as all paths are. But it is the one most consistent with our character and courage as a nation and our commitments around the world. The cost of freedom is always high, but Americans have always paid it. And one path we shall never choose, and that is the path of surrender or submission. Our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right. Not peace at the expense of freedom, but both peace and freedom here in this hemisphere, and we hope around the world. God willing, that goal will be achieved. Thank you and good night.
So this was the national mood I was born into. Less than 20 years before my birth, the world experienced the horrors of Auschwitz, the complete destruction of Germany, the division of Europe into a free, democratic, and capitalist West and a totalitarian and communist East. And this whole toxic brew of simmering differences was kept in check by the threat of mutually assured destruction provided by two massive arsenals of atomic bombs. There was another song from Germany released in 1983, which masterfully expressed the pervasive mood of tension and uncertainty which hung over the world at the time. The song was originally written in German, but became so popular all around the world that the artist recorded an English version as well. I remember dancing at frat parties in college to the German version of this song, which was quite an odd spectacle when you think about it. I mean, can you think of a single German song you've ever danced to? Me neither. There was just this one song. The song is called 99 Luftballon, or 99 Red Balloons in English, and is sung by Nena.
Hast du etwas Zeit für mich? Singe ich ein Lied für dich von 99 Luftballons auf ihrem Weg zum Horizont. Denkst du vielleicht gerade an mich? Singe ich ein Lied für dich von 99 Luftballons, und dass sowas von sowas kommt.
This was the part we danced to in between games of beer pong. The German version was called 99 Balloons, but they translated it into English as 99 Red Balloons, just to even out the syllables. But it's probably not a coincidence that they picked the color red, which is the symbol for communism. The song is about someone who innocently releases 99 balloons into the sky, which get picked up on radar by the military bases and interpreted as an incoming missile, which triggers a nuclear war.
99 red balloons floating in the summer sky. Panic belt, it's red alert. There's something here from somewhere else. The war machine springs to life, opens up one eager eye, focusing it on the sky. The 99 red balloons go by.
This was not as absurd a thought as it might seem at first hearing. Remember the image of a red telephone on the president's desk? Well, we always assumed that the Russian president also had a red phone on his desk so that they could quickly talk in case there were ever some red balloons in the sky. 99 Decision Street, 99 ministers meet to worry, worry, super scurry, call the troops out in a hurry. This is what we've waited for. This is it, boys. This is war. The president is on the line as 99 red balloons go by.
99 Decision Street, 99 ministers meet to worry, worry, super scary. Call the troops out in a hurry. This is what we've waited for. This is it, boys. This is war. The president is on the line as 99 red balloons go by.
Embedded in this song is the common belief at the time that there was a so-called military-industrial complex which secretly wanted war so they could get rich manufacturing weapons. The war machine springs to life, opens up one eager eye, and this is what we've waited for. This is it, boys. This is war. The song ends with nuclear annihilation, of course. That was everyone's worst fear at the time. 99 dreams I have had, in every one a red balloon. It's all over and I'm standing pretty in this dust that was a city. If I could find a souvenir just to prove the world was here, and here is a red balloon, I think of you and let it go.
99 dreams I have had, every one a red balloon. It's all standing pretty in this dust that was a city. If I could find a souvenir just to prove the world was here, and here is a red balloon, I think of you and let it go.
That was the mood at the time. We all feared nuclear Armageddon, and we just got used to that pervasive fear. That was the way it was, and that was the way it would always be. I find it fascinating that young people today don't have this fear much, not that I can tell anyway. And yet it seems to me that there is even more danger of nuclear Armageddon nowadays than there was back then, given that so many more nations have nuclear weapons than ever before. The US, Russia, China, Israel, India, Pakistan, North Korea, not to mention England and France as well, with many more countries working hard behind the scenes to get their own big ones. Iran comes to mind. Instead, young people today fear climate change as public enemy number one. I wonder how the climate would be affected if 99 nuclear bombs went off all around the world. Something to think about, anyway.
How dare you!
Young people today might have a hard time wrapping their heads around the Cold War and what it was all about. But it's not really that complicated. In fact, it's deceptively simple to grasp. Here's my elevator pitch on the subject, which I will call the Cold War for Dummies. Okay, so a bunch of college students and intellectuals read some books by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels and decided that those guys were really onto something. So they started a revolution in Russia so they could try out all these great new ideas in a real country with real people. They took over the army and the police. Then they nationalized all the private businesses and put a bunch of really smart people in charge of everything. If you've already listened to episode 23, Equality and Envy, you'll remember I talk about a writer named Edward Bellamy, who wrote an amazing little book called Looking Backward. Bellamy wrote his book about 20 years after Marx wrote his bestseller. But if the college students in Russia found Marx as compelling as I found Bellamy, well, then I can understand why they threw a revolution. Wow, what a chance this was to get on the right side of history. I mean, who doesn't want to be on the right side of history? I know I do. Anyway, there was the Russian Revolution, and it marked the beginning of a grand experiment that would last about 70 years, from 1917 until 1989, to be precise. This experiment represented a fresh, new approach to running society. Instead of letting people run amok in their own affairs and turning over the fate of the economy and the nation to private individuals pursuing their own self-interest in a competitive, dog-eat-dog manner, the economy would be centrally planned and centrally directed, with the smartest people in society at the helm. This all seemed to make tremendous sense at the time, and many of the most prominent intellectuals in America and Europe believed in this grand new experiment, and they were rooting for the Soviet Union, as this new Russia was called, to succeed in its revamping of human society. I feel it's important to understand the Cold War as a battle between two distinct economic systems. On the one side, you have capitalism, or what Sowell calls a price-coordinated society, under which prices get determined by the interplay of millions of consumers making personal decisions on a minute-by-minute basis. On the other side, you have socialism or communism, under which prices are determined by central authorities. It makes sense that Sowell would view things this way. After all, he is an economist by profession. But I think it even makes sense for us non-economists to view things this way as well. Of course, we can talk about democracy, about freedom, about justice, about human rights, and these are powerful and useful subjects. The problem with these concepts is that they are hard to measure, and honest men can easily disagree on even what the very words mean. For example, one of my pet peeves is this whole concept of democracy and how everyone is always saying this or that is a threat to our democracy. I personally am not a big fan of pure democracy. The thought that 51% of the people can tell me what to do is kind of scary, to be frank. I much prefer a constitutional republic with clear limits on what the government can and can't do to me, an individual. Another example is the concept of freedom. For some, freedom means the freedom of the individual from the encroachments of his fellow man. For others, freedom might mean freedom from economic insecurity. All I'm saying is that these moral concepts can get tricky and complicated. But if you view the Cold War solely as two competing economic systems, suddenly you're able to judge the results in a scientific and empirical way, without a lot of excess emotion and moral grandstanding. I think this was Sowell's approach mostly. And luckily for us, Sowell has devoted decades of his life and thousands of hours looking into the facts about these two competing economic systems. I consider three Sowell books to be milestones on this subject. Number one is Knowledge and Decisions, which he published in 1980. Number two is Basic Economics, which he gave to the world 20 years later. Number three is Intellectuals and Society, which he gave to us in 2010. I can't possibly overstate the importance of reading these three Sowell books. I really shouldn't say reading them. I should say studying them, especially Basic Economics. These three books will literally rewire the way your brain works and the way you see the world. In Intellectuals and Society, Sowell makes the argument that 99% of all consequential knowledge is widely distributed among the entire population and is not concentrated in the brains of the smartest people. Sowell says this:
when both special knowledge and mundane knowledge are encompassed within the concept of knowledge, it is doubtful whether the most knowledgeable person on earth has even 1% of the total knowledge on earth, or even 1% of the consequential knowledge in a given society.
What does Sowell mean by the term consequential knowledge? In an interview with Peter Robinson, Sowell said that consequential knowledge is knowledge whose presence or absence has serious consequences. But is Sowell exaggerating when he says that the smartest people possess less than 1% of the total important knowledge in society? Sowell says this:
many intellectuals and their followers have been unduly impressed by the fact that highly educated elites, like themselves, have far more knowledge per capita, in the sense of special knowledge, than does the population at large. From this, it is a short step to considering the educated elites to be superior guides to what should and should not be done in a society. They have often overlooked the crucial fact that the population at large may have vastly more total knowledge, in the mundane sense, than the elites, even if that knowledge is scattered in individually unimpressive fragments among vast numbers of people.
This passage from Intellectuals and Society prepares our minds for one of the best Sowell quotes ever. Quote, "A diamond may be worth much more than a penny, but enough pennies will be worth more than any diamond." If you accept Sowell's premise that 99% of the important knowledge in a society is widely distributed among the population at large, you will start to understand why command economies can never function effectively, no matter how smart the elites who run them are. Very often, when a command or socialist economy fails, its supporters and boosters lament, "If only we had had the right people in charge, things would have turned out differently." But according to Sowell, no matter who is in charge of a command economy, no matter how brilliant, honest, and well-intentioned those persons might be, they can at most possess only a small fraction of the total knowledge which that society depends upon to function effectively. This is an important piece of the puzzle which explains why command economies never succeed in creating lasting wealth for their citizens, no matter how many natural resources they possess, because most of the consequential knowledge in those societies is being ignored or suppressed by the centralization of decision-making. Sowell says this, quote, The sharp rise and sharper fall of central planning in the 20th century, even in countries run by communists or socialists, suggests a flaw in the assumptions of those with the vision of the anointed, a flaw not necessarily confined to economic policies. The failure of central planning, despite its having all the advantages that the intelligentsia consider crucial, advantages of intellect, education, vast amounts of statistical and other information, and a coherent plan backed by government power, suggests that something must have been left out of the equation. The enormous fragmentation of consequential knowledge is one of those things, and the heterogeneity of people, not only among groups, but even among individuals, including members of the same family, is another. Thinking in terms of abstract people in an abstract world makes it possible to glide over such things, but reality does not go away when it is ignored. End quote. Another piece of the puzzle can be found in Sowell's Basic Economics, where he explains the crucial role which freely floating prices play in transmitting and communicating a vast body of consequential knowledge throughout the society. Sowell says this:
prices play a crucial role in determining how much of each resource gets used where, and how the resulting products get transferred to millions of people. Yet this role is seldom understood by the public, and it is often disregarded entirely by politicians. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, in her memoirs, said that Mikhail Gorbachev had little understanding of economics, even though he was at that time the leader of the largest nation on earth.
Perhaps the best way to convey the contrast between the command economies of the Soviet Union and the price-coordinated economies of Europe and America is to hear Sowell's description of Boris Yeltsin's visit to a Houston supermarket.
A turning point in Yeltsin's intellectual development occurred during his first visit to the United States in September 1989, more specifically, his first visit to an American supermarket in Houston, Texas. The sight of aisle after aisle of shelves neatly stacked with every conceivable type of foodstuff and household item, each in a dozen varieties, both amazed and depressed him. For Yeltsin, like many other first-time Russian visitors to America, this was infinitely more impressive than tourist attractions like the Statue of Liberty and the Lincoln Memorial. It was impressive precisely because of its ordinariness. A cornucopia of consumer goods beyond the imagination of most Soviets was within the reach of ordinary citizens without standing in line for hours, and it was all so attractively displayed. For someone brought up in the drab conditions of communism, even a member of the relatively privileged elite, a visit to a Western supermarket involved a full-scale assault on the senses. When he returned to Moscow, Yeltsin spoke of the pain he felt after seeing in Houston the contrast between American and Soviet living standards. He described what he had seen in America to what was described as a stunned Moscow audience. Yeltsin's aide said that the Houston supermarket experience destroyed the last vestiges of Yeltsin's belief in the communist system, setting the stage for his becoming the first leader of post-communist Russia.
I love this supermarket story because I have always felt it is crucially important for world leaders to visit other countries and explore other systems before they become world leaders. Once you become the leader of your country, it is no longer possible to truly get to know another country and another way of life. All your visits as a leader are state visits, and every minute of every day is curated with meetings, press conferences, dinners at embassies, and all that jazz. Forget about strolling the aisles of Whole Foods and making your own peanut butter in one of those self-service peanut grinders. That's out of the question. I feel that world travel should almost be a prerequisite for national leadership. I mean, how can you judge your own society if you have no idea how it's done in other places? It's nice to think America is the greatest country on earth, but if you've never been to another country besides maybe Cancun on spring break, what are you comparing it to? As Henny Youngman once said, when someone asked him, "How's your wife?" he answered, "Compared to what?" In Basic Economics, Sowell argues that a capitalist economy, solves one of the oldest problems known to man. I call it the who watches the watchman problem. This problem is so old, there's a Latin phrase for it. Qui custodiet ipsos custodes. Sowell uses a different expression in his works. He says, who monitors the monitors? But the basic problem is this. Who keeps an eye on the people who are supposed to be keeping an eye on everyone else? Who monitors the monitors? Sowell says this.
While capitalists have been conceived of as people who make profits, what a business owner really gets is legal ownership of whatever residual is left over after the costs have been paid out of the money received from customers. That residual can turn out to be positive, negative, or zero. Workers must be paid and creditors must be paid, or else they can take legal action to seize the company's assets. Even before that happens, they can simply stop supplying their inputs when the company stops paying them. The only person whose payment is contingent on how well the business is doing is the owner of that business. This is what puts unrelenting pressure on the owner to monitor everything that is happening in the business and everything that is happening in the market for the business's products. In contrast to the layers of authorities monitoring the actions of those under them in a government-run enterprise, the business owner is essentially an unmonitored monitor as far as the economic efficiency of the business is concerned. Self-interest takes the place of external monitors and forces far closer attention to details and far more expenditure of time and energy at work than any set of rules or authorities is likely to be able to do. That simple fact gives capitalism an enormous advantage. More important, it gives the people living in price-coordinated market economies visibly higher standards of living.
So Sowell says that the capitalist system enables there to be a whole class of unmonitored monitors, the capitalists, the people who only get paid if there is something left over after everyone else is paid. He gives a concrete example of a Soviet farm.
The average Soviet farm, for example, was 10 times the size of the average American farm and employed more than 10 times as many workers. But Soviet farms were notoriously inefficient. Among the reasons for this inefficiency cited by Soviet economists was deficient coordination. One example may illustrate a general problem. In the vast common fields, fleets of tractors fanned out to begin the plowing. Plan fulfillment was calculated on the basis of hectares worked, and so it was to the driver's advantage to cover as much territory as quickly as possible. The drivers started by cutting deep furrows around the edge of the fields. As they moved deeper into the fields, however, they began to lift the blade of the plow and race the tractor, and the furrows became progressively shallower. The first furrows were 9 to 10 inches deep. A little farther from the road, they were 5 to 6 inches deep, and in the center of the field, where the tractor drivers were certain that no one would check on them, the furrows were as little as 2 inches deep. Usually, no one discovered that the furrows were so shallow in the middle of the field until it became obvious that something was wrong from the stunted nature of the crop. Once again, counterproductive behavior from the standpoint of the economy was not irrational behavior from the standpoint of the person engaging in it. Clearly, the tractor drivers understood that their work could be more easily monitored at the edge of a field than in the center, and they adjusted the kind and quality of work they did accordingly, so as to maximize their own pay based on how much land they plowed. By not plowing as deeply into the ground where they could not be easily monitored by farm officials, tractor drivers were able to go faster and cover more ground in a given amount of time, even if they covered it less effectively. No such behavior would be likely by a farmer plowing his own land in a market economy, because his actions would be controlled by the incentive of profit, rather than by external monitors.
So we learn from Sowell's writings on the subject, there are many reasons a price-coordinated capitalist society must outperform a command economy, having nothing to do with moralistic considerations about freedom, equality, fairness, and other such ethical factors. It's just the way economies work. In the summer after I graduated college, I, like many other college students of my era, purchased a Eurail pass, a paperback copy of Let's Go Europe, and headed to Kennedy Airport with a couple thousand dollars worth of American Express traveler's checks tucked away in my secret money belt, and began my adventure to Europe. Bouncing from one youth hostel to another, I got a taste for what life in other countries was like. From England to France to Holland to Germany, Italy, Greece, Spain, and all the rest. In Western Europe, at least. I got to taste the exquisite French and Italian cuisines. I got to experience the perfectly timed German trains and buses, the immaculately clean streets of Switzerland, and I got to wonder why things were different from back home. Some things were better there, and some things were worse. But it at least opened my mind to the notion that our way isn't the only way. But still, traveling around Western Europe wasn't all that different from being in the United States. Everything was all still well within the Overton window. It wasn't until 3 years later, when I was in business school, I went to Germany for a semester-long exchange program, that the real quest began. It was 1987, 2 years before the fall of the Berlin Wall. In the summer after that program, me and a friend purchased a used Russian car for 1,400 Deutschmarks, a red Lada, and we started out on the ultimate adventure. We were going to spend the summer visiting every country in Eastern Europe. Yes, we were going to travel behind the Iron Curtain and see for ourselves what life was really like under communism. Over a three-month period, we went to East Germany, Poland, Russia, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and even Yugoslavia. Yuga who? The only country we didn't make it to was Albania because, well, no one went to Albania back then. It was just too extreme. So I got to experience what life was really like under a totally different economic system from capitalism. I got to visit their supermarkets and see where Boris Yeltsin went shopping before he became the head honcho. It was a truly sobering experience, and someday I'd love to share stories and impressions about that trip. For the sake of brevity, let me share just one story here that will give you some idea of how otherworldly it was. We went to a bookstore in a small city in Romania. They had books on many subjects, from mathematics to botany to history, all in Romanian, of course. Amazingly, however, all of these books were written by the same person, who just happened to be Romania's lifetime president, none other than Nicolae Ceaușescu himself. I know you think I am making this story up, but trust me, my imagination is not that creative. So anyway, the Cold War and the competition between these two economic systems is not just an intellectual curiosity for me. It's personal. I've been there. I've felt it in my bones. I'll bet I've seen more of Eastern Europe than even Boris Yeltsin did. At the same time I was browsing the bookshops of Romania, Ronald Reagan made a historic visit to Berlin. On June 12, 1987, he gave a speech at the Berlin Wall, which will go down in history as one of those speeches which only a true leader could give. He ignored the advice and warnings of his staff and the State Department, and he delivered a clear and direct message to the Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev. Ronald Reagan said this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Behind me stands a wall that encircles the free sectors of this city, part of a vast system of barriers that divides the entire continent of Europe. From the Baltic South, those barriers cut across Germany in a gash of barbed wire, concrete, dog runs, and guard towers. Farther south, there may be no visible, no obvious wall, but there remain armed guards and checkpoints all the same. Still a restriction on the right to travel. Still an instrument to impose upon ordinary men and women the will of a totalitarian state. Yet it is here in Berlin where the wall emerges most clearly. Here, cutting across your city, where the news photo and the television screen have imprinted this brutal division of a continent upon the mind of the world. Standing before the Brandenburg Gate, every man is a German, separated from his fellow men. In the 1950s, Khrushchev predicted, "We will bury you." But in the West today, we see a free world that has achieved a level of prosperity and well-being unprecedented in all human history. In the communist world, we see failure, technological backwardness, declining standards of health. And now the Soviets themselves may, in a limited way, be coming to understand the importance of freedom. We hear much from Moscow about a new policy of reform and openness. Some political prisoners have been released. Certain foreign news broadcasts are no longer being jammed. Some economic enterprises have been permitted to operate with greater freedom from state control. Are these the beginnings of profound changes in the Soviet state, or are they token gestures intended to raise false hopes in the West or to strengthen the Soviet system without changing it? We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together, that the advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace. There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable, that would advance dramatically the cause of freedom and peace. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Joining me later in this episode is the man who wrote that speech for Ronald Reagan. Can you imagine writing the words, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," and putting them on the desk of the President of the United States? Well, Peter Robinson did just that. Many of you know Peter Robinson as the man who conducts the best interviews of Thomas Sowell on YouTube. And indeed, he is that man. But you may not also know that he was Ronald Reagan's chief speechwriter for several years, and he penned over 300 speeches for both Reagan and his vice president, George Bush. When I returned from our months-long trip to Eastern Europe, I will never forget the interaction I had with the customs officer back at Kennedy Airport in New York City. He was flipping through my passport and looking at all the visa stamps I had collected from behind the Iron Curtain. He looked up and asked me, "Why did you spend so much time in communist countries?" I looked him straight in the eye and said, "I'm an American, and I don't have to answer that question." He stared at me in cold silence for a few seconds. I stared right back at him with a stern expression on my face. Suddenly, a smile spread across his face, and he said, "Welcome home," which was followed by the ka-chunk sound of one of those old metal stamps placing an entry stamp on one of the few blank pages in my passport. Little did I know at that moment that just 2 years later, I would be moving to Berlin to participate in the revolutionary movements which would soon transform Europe and the world. There was another song which impacted me at the time. It was called "Berlin, City of Night," and was written and sung by the German composer Peter Schilling in 1985. The same year, Gorbachev was elected General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. In Berlin, city of night, you sleep between the east and west, along the left and right. Broken, kept from the light. You close your eyes, and everything remains in black and white. Berlin, when will you fight? The mine that draws the border, no one crosses in the city of night. Talk about a powerful song. Schilling included a clip of President John F. Kennedy's famous Berlin speech in his song.
Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, ich bin ein Berliner.
Berlin, city of night, you sleep between the east and west, along the left and right.
Let's rewind the clock back to June 26, 1963. It was less than 1 year since the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Kennedy traveled to Berlin to show his support for the people of West Berlin. He gave what I personally consider to be the best speech ever given by a U.S. president. Here's President John F. Kennedy at the Berlin Wall, exactly 150 days before he was to succumb to an assassin's bullet.
There are many people in the world who really don't understand, or say they don't, what is the great issue between the free world and the communist world. Let them come to Berlin. There are some who say that communism is the wave of the future. Let them come to Berlin. And there are some who say, in Europe and elsewhere, we can work with the communists. Let them come to Berlin. And there are even a few who say that it's true that communism is an evil system, but it permits us to make economic progress. Lass sie nach Berlin kommen. Let them come to Berlin. Freedom has many difficulties, and democracy is not perfect. But we have never had to put a wall up to keep our people in, to prevent them from leaving us. I want to say, on behalf of my countrymen who live many miles away on the other side of the Atlantic, who are far distant from you, that they take the greatest pride, that they have been able to share with you, even from a distance, the story of the last 18 years. I know of no town, no city that has been besieged for 18 years that still lives with the vitality and the force and the hope and the determination of the city of West Berlin. While the wall is the most obvious and vivid demonstration of the failures of the communist system, for all the world to see we take no satisfaction in it. For it is, as your mayor has said, an offense not only against history, but an offense against humanity, separating families, dividing husbands and wives and brothers and sisters, and dividing a people who wish to be joined together. What is true of this city is true of Germany. Real, lasting peace in Europe can never be assured as long as one German out of four is denied the elementary right of free men, and that is to make a free choice. In 18 years of peace and good faith, this generation of Germans has earned the right to be free, including the right to unite their families and their nation in lasting peace with goodwill to all people. You live in a defended island of freedom, but your life is part of the Maine. So let me ask you as I close to lift your eyes beyond the dangers of today to the hopes of tomorrow, beyond the freedom merely of this city of Berlin or your country of Germany, to the advance of freedom everywhere, beyond the wall, to the day of peace with justice, beyond yourselves and ourselves, to all mankind. Freedom is indivisible, and when one man is enslaved, all are not free. When all are free, then we can look forward to that day when this city will be joined as one, and this country and this great continent of Europe in a peaceful and hopeful globe. When that day finally comes, as it will, the people of West Berlin can take sober satisfaction in the fact that they were in the front lines for almost two decades. All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner. Fast forward to November of 1989. I was an account executive at a big New York City ad agency working on the Vicks account. You know, Vicks VapoRub, NyQuil, Formula 44, and all that stuff. If you've ever watched Mad Men, you will know exactly what it was not like. Trust me, this was boring stuff. Sitting behind a two-way mirror, watching suburban moms sharing their innermost thoughts and feelings about cough syrup. Yep, I was living the dream. Well, on November 9th, 1989, all that was about to change. I was sitting in front of the TV in my tiny studio apartment on 64th Street, watching the news. And there was Tom Brokaw reporting live from Berlin, describing how the Berlin Wall had been opened.
Earlier this evening, the Communist Central Committee in East Berlin proposed an action program, including free elections and a democratic coalition government. Tonight, citizens from both Germanys are singing and dancing on the wall itself, reunited right on top of that harsh symbol of division. Thousands of East Berliners have been pouring into West Berlin since the borders were opened. And tonight, in this city, famous for its carefree nightlife, in this city where the song says, life is a cabaret, tonight in Berlin, it is Freedom Night.
I will never forget that moment. I was stunned. I was shocked. I never saw this coming. We had all gotten so used to that wall, we couldn't imagine any turn of events which could possibly lead to its fall. Immediately, I was overcome with a vision. I knew from my experience backpacking across Europe that in the coming summer, every tourist from all over the world was going to go to Berlin to see the wall. And I thought to myself, if I had a t-shirt shop at Checkpoint Charlie, I would make a killing. I rushed to the phone and I called my mom. Mom, are you watching what's going on TV in Berlin? Yeah, I'm watching. It's amazing. I know, I said. What do you think of this idea? I will move to Berlin and open up a t-shirt shop at Checkpoint Charlie selling shirts to tourists. I'll make a killing. There was dead silence on the other end of the phone. I kept quiet, waiting for her response. As they say in negotiations, whoever speaks first loses. And then suddenly, out of the blue, my mother said, "What are you waiting for?" That was all I needed to hear. I knew the idea was rock solid, if even my mother liked it. The next day, I gave notice at the ad agency, and 2 weeks later, I was on a plane to Berlin, with nothing in my pocket but $1,000 and a dream. It took me 3 months to open up a shop, find a t-shirt printing factory, and to gather the photos and artwork I needed to print a variety of shirts. While I was getting the shop ready and printing shirts, I made enough money to support myself by renting hammers and chisels to tourists looking to chip away their own piece of the Berlin Wall as a souvenir. I remember those days like it was yesterday. I would set up a blanket with about 10 sets of hammers and chisels with a sign that said, "Rent a hammer and chisel, 5 Deutschmarks for 15 minutes. People would drop money in my hand, take the tools, and just bring them back when they were done. What a time to be alive. But I finally made it. After the fall, Berlin, which is what I named the t-shirt shop, opened right at Checkpoint Charlie on the Friedrichstrasse in April of 1990, just 1 month before the flood of backpackers was to begin. Did I make a killing? You bet your Wiener Schnitzel I did. Well, not by today's standards of tech millionaires and billionaires, but by the standards of a kid from Queens, New York, it was a good start. But more important than the money I made was the appetite for and habits of entrepreneurship which I had developed during those 5 years in Berlin. I have a feeling that was my mother's master plan in encouraging me to go to Berlin. She probably would have said the same thing no matter what harebrained business idea I had come up with. Mom, what do you think about me opening up an electric fork factory? What are you waiting for? She would have said. She was a genius in her own way. Now, while all those tourists were buying t-shirts with wall graffiti printed on them and hacking off pieces of the Berlin Wall to take home as souvenirs, I had something else in mind, something special. Ever since Berlin was divided into 4 sectors at the end of World War II, a Russian, British, French, and an American sector, there were large signs posted along the perimeter of the American sector. On one side of the sign was the words, "You are leaving the American sector," in 4 languages, English, Russian, French, and German. On the other side it said, "You are entering the American sector. Carrying weapons off-duty forbidden. Obey traffic rules," also in all 4 languages. These signs were 8 feet wide and 7 feet tall, hand-painted on thick wood and mounted into the ground atop thick wooden posts. There were a few of them around the former American sector in Berlin, but there was one in particular which was world famous, the one at Checkpoint Charlie. This sign had been photographed by millions of tourists from all over the world who stood under that sign. I was one of them. I'll put a link in the show notes to a photo of me taken in the spring of 1990. I had pulled my car under the sign, and I was sitting on the trunk, smiling at the camera. Little did I know at that moment that one day that very sign would be hanging on my living room wall in Los Angeles. How did that happen? you are probably wondering. Before I tell the story of how I acquired what is possibly the most famous sign in the world, there's one more German song from that era I want to tell you about. It was written by Marius Müller-Westernhagen in 1987, just 2 years before the fall of the wall, and it's called Freiheit, which is the German word for freedom. Westernhagen claims he didn't write the song about the wall or the inner German division, but the German people didn't care. That's the way they understood the song. You can feel the emotion in the concert hall when Westernhagen sings his powerful ballad a few weeks after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Alle die von Freiheit träumen, sollen feiern nicht versäumen, so wie wir heute Abend hier, sollen tanzen auch auf Gräbern. Ist das einzige, was zählt?
Freiheit ist das einzige, was zählt. Freiheit ist das einzige, was fehlt. Freedom is the only thing that matters. Freedom is the only thing that's missing. The conversation about freedom is an important one. Sowell focuses a lot on economic freedom and why it's the only system which harnesses the knowledge and skills of the many. The end of the Cold War was a partial victory for people who believe in the power of economic freedom. The command economies of Russia and Eastern Europe failed to provide for their peoples economically. That was proven definitively. Those societies cast off their command economies and embraced capitalism and free markets starting in 1990. But the love of individual freedom is not as widespread as we would like to believe. Many people, even in our own country, are willing to sacrifice personal freedom in exchange for safety and security. The general response to the COVID pandemic made that very clear to me. In China, a hybrid experiment is underway. The Chinese are attempting to embrace the mechanisms of capitalism in order to enjoy the prosperity it provides, while at the same time denying individual liberty and political freedom. China is still a political and social dictatorship, no matter how many fun drones and cameras they sell us. The Chinese-owned company TikTok is the perfect symbol of the Chinese experiment. Successful economically at home and abroad, but tightly controlled and censored within China. I'd like to suggest that the Cold War is not really over. It merely got moved to another venue. And the new Cold War we are in with China may be much more dangerous than the old one, because at least we were aware we were in the old one. This new one is much more subtle and stealthy. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest today, Peter Robinson. Peter is the Murdoch Distinguished Policy Fellow at the Hoover Institution. He edits Hoover's quarterly journal, The Hoover Digest, and hosts Hoover's video series program, Uncommon Knowledge. I'm sure most, if not all of you, know Peter from that show, because some of the best interviews of Thomas Sowell took place at Peter's table at the Hoover Institute.
Dr. Thomas Sowell on Uncommon Knowledge now.
Robinson is also the author of three books: How Ronald Reagan Changed My Life, It's My Party, A Republican's Messy Love Affair with the GOP, and his last book, Snapshots from Hell, The Making of an MBA. In 1979, when I was still a high school senior, Peter graduated from Dartmouth College, where he majored in English. He went on to study politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford University, from which he graduated in 1982. Peter spent 6 years in the White House, serving from 1982 to 1983 as chief speechwriter to Vice President George Bush, and from 1983 to 1988 as special assistant and speechwriter to President Ronald Reagan. He wrote the historic Berlin Wall Address, in which Reagan called on General Secretary Gorbachev to tear down this wall. Peter Robinson, welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure, such an honor to meet you. I've been watching your videos with Thomas Sowell for many years now, and it's great to finally meet you. And I guess my first question for you is, before I even ask you about Thomas Sowell, I guess I just want to know, you know, what you want to say about Thomas Sowell. So before I lead you in a certain direction, what do you have to say about the man?
Tom Sowell, the second most striking thing about Tom Sowell is that he's really smart. He is well-read and quick and has a mind that has mastered masses of material and gone right down to the bottom of things and achieved real wisdom. But that's only the second most. That's the thing that strikes one first, I think. But the most striking feature, I think I would argue, is that Tom Sowell is a free man. And this is what I mean. He is free from any consideration about what other people think of him, about criticism, any sense of intellectual fashion. He just doesn't care about anything but the truth as he has dug it out. So that's pretty remarkable. Most of the rest of us, I certainly, feel concerned about what other people think of us. We find ourselves in ways small and large, hedging what we say, qualifying what we say, holding back from certain comments. There's just none of that in Tom. He's just free.
How do you think he got that way?
Hard work. Tom has not plucked his views out of the air. There's nothing about him that comes from reading a few front pages of newspapers or listening to television shows like The View. Tom's conclusions are just that. They're conclusions that grow out of life experience and a lot of very hard work, reading and writing above all. So he knows what he thinks, and he knows why he thinks it. And his thoughts represent achievements. He just, more than almost anybody else I've met, more than anybody, very few people, he knows exactly where he stands and why he stands there. And that frees him from considerations of what other people might think of him.
Now, that having been said, he does seem to have a willingness to change his mind.
Oh, yes. That's one of the great stories. That's one of the great intellectual narratives of his life, that he started out on the left. And he has explained this, of course, that when he was a kid growing up in Harlem, one of his first jobs was as a Western Union telegram delivery boy. And that would take him into Manhattan. He'd take the bus back home to Harlem from Midtown Manhattan, and he'd go up. I guess he actually can still remember the route, I can't remember which bus route, but I think it was Lexington Avenue maybe, or Madison Avenue. And you're there with the great shops and the big office buildings. And then you pass big, beautiful apartment buildings where rich people lived. And then the bus would continue on to Harlem, and it would go through poor neighborhoods. And he wanted to know why the world was built that way. Why were there rich people? Why were there poor people? And the first explanation that he came across, this was in the air when he was a young man. The first explanation that he came across was Marxism. And it took him some years. So he was a real man of the left. And he even told me once that when he studied under Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago, he respected Milton's intelligence. But Tom was a man of the left even then. And even Milton Friedman didn't budge him. This actually gets back to the question you asked: how has he achieved that freedom? How is it that he's come to his views? And for some intellectuals, it's just sort of mind games, building intellectual models. But Tom's, there's no distance between Tom's intellect and his own life experience. Milton Friedman didn't make you a conservative. What did? And Tom does not respond by saying a book. He doesn't say Hayek finally convinced him or Adam Smith. He doesn't say that. He says that working for the United States government convinced him, that he saw that the actual incentives were not to do good for people, but for bureaucrats to feather their own nests, to build little bureaucratic empires. It was life experience that changed his mind, coupled with life experience in light of constant reading.
One of the reasons that I was really excited to have you on the show was because I know about your experience writing speeches for Ronald Reagan and being, you know, what I call a cold warrior, someone who grew up during the Cold War. And obviously working for Reagan, you really got to experience that behind the curtain, behind the scenes. And I know that you went to Berlin. I heard your story about going to Berlin and preparing the speech. What really amazes me about the Berlin story and the Berlin Wall is how few people really know the story, really know the history of Berlin. And I, you know, I suspect that young people today, if you were to say to them, do you know anything about the Berlin Wall? I would say 99 out of 100 will just shrug their shoulders and say they really don't know what that is. One of the things I'd like to tell you about is, you know, my story with the Berlin Wall and my, you know, how my experience came about. So in 1987, I was getting my MBA at New York University. I know you got your MBA at Stanford, right?
That's right.
Okay. So I was at NYU and they offered an exchange program for one semester. And I picked the University of Cologne in Germany because I really was interested in that. So I started learning German. And when I applied for the exchange program, they asked me, can you speak German? And I lied and I said, yes. But the truth was I could barely speak at all. And without them checking, they sent me to Germany and I started studying there at the University of Cologne. And I remember the people that greeted me with the exchange program, they thought to themselves, how is this guy going to make it? He can barely speak German at all. Well, suffice it to say that in 6 months, I became completely fluent in German. I mean, I just worked my butt off. And to this day, I'm still very fluent in German and I read German magazines and I love it. So that was 1987. In the summer of 1987, when you were traveling to Berlin to do some reconnaissance about the speech, right. I convinced a friend of mine to split a Russian Lada with me, which was the Russian car. We got in that car and then we spent the next 3 months traveling to every country in Eastern Europe. We went to Poland,
really?
Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Russia. We drove to all these places and we spent 3 months traveling behind the Iron Curtain. So I was fascinated by this because I had read a lot about the Eastern Bloc and communism, but I wanted to see it for myself, what it was really like to live in those countries. So I made a lot of friends. I met a lot of people. And when you were an American back then, people were so thrilled to talk to you because for them, it was almost like traveling. Talking to an American was like traveling.
Right.
And because they couldn't leave.
They couldn't. Right.
Okay. So we finished that trip. We sold the Lada and I returned back to New York where I graduated from my MBA program and I was working at an advertising agency. Fast forward to November.
You stayed in New York?
I stayed in New York. Yeah, I stayed in New York. Fast forward to 1989, November 9th, the Berlin Wall is opened. You remember that date very well.
Of course I do.
I remember sitting in my apartment watching Dan Brokaw reporting live from the Berlin Wall. And I just had this inspiration. I remember very distinctly, I called up my mother and I said, Mom, what do you think about me moving to Berlin and opening up a t-shirt shop at Checkpoint Charlie? I'll bet you millions of tourists are going to go to Berlin this summer and I will make a killing. And my mother said, what are you waiting for? And I said, oh my God, if my mother thinks this is a good idea, I mean, it must be a terrific idea. So I quit my job. I gave notice the next day. And I, 2 weeks later, I flew to Berlin with practically no money in my pocket. I was really winging it. And I started to try to figure out how to open up a t-shirt shop at Checkpoint Charlie. So I won't give you the whole story, but a few months later, I was finally able to secure a space right at Checkpoint Charlie.
Really?
And I started photographing all the graffiti that was on the Berlin Wall. And I founded a t-shirt factory in Berlin that would print that graffiti on t-shirts. And one of the t-shirts that we printed was a picture of the sign that was at Checkpoint Charlie that says, you are leaving the American sector. Are you familiar with this sign?
Oh, sure. Achtung, vous sortez du secteur américain.
Exactly.
In three languages. Yes, right. I exactly. don't know German, but a little bit of French.
On one side, it says you are leaving the American sector. On the other side, it says you are entering the American sector, because that sign was put there for the soldiers to know when they were crossing the barrier right. before the wall was built. Okay. So I ran this t-shirt shop for several years. And in 1990, the newspapers announced that they were going to be dismantling Checkpoint Charlie, and the American, the British, and the French soldiers were going to be going home on a certain date. I think it was June 22nd, 1990. Mm-hmm. So me and three friends hatched a plan. That night, we were going to go out in the middle of the night. And when the guards weren't there anymore, we were going to grab the sign, you are leaving the American sector. And we went to Checkpoint Charlie, but we noticed there were still East German border guards still at the checkpoint. So we decided to go to a different spot to take a sign. There was another sign located on the Sonnenallee. So we drove to the Sonnenallee and there were no guards there. We sawed down the sign, we put it in our truck, and we were like, yes, we did it. And this thing is like, you know, 10 feet wide. I mean, it's a big sign. So drunk with the success of the crime we had just committed, and I was driving the truck, I said, we're going to Checkpoint Charlie. So I turned the truck around, we went back to Checkpoint Charlie, and we started sawing down that sign as well. And while we were in the middle of sawing down that sign, we spotted two machine gun toting East German guards walking towards us. We quickly threw the saws in the back of the truck and pretended to be American tourists speaking English, photographing ourselves in front of the sign. The guards were so convinced that they actually took pictures with us in front of the
really?
Sign. Yeah. When they left to continue their patrol, we finished sawing down the sign and we took it with us. So I actually still have, 32 years later, I still have both of those signs.
Wow.
In
How did
my
you
possession.
Get them back to this country?
On a container. Really? With my furniture when I moved back. I've been schlepping them around with me from office to office, apartment to apartment. And they finally ended up here in Los Angeles with me. And I have one in my basement and one hanging on the living room wall.
Wonderful.
So that's, you know, so while everybody else was taking little pieces of the wall, I went for the big kahuna and I got the sign, the original sign. And if you like, I can show you the sign right now.
I would like that.
Would you like to see that? Okay.
I would.
Let me open up the Zoom on my phone. Okay, here we go. I'm going to mute this now. See how I do that. Here we go.
Okay. Peter, can you see me?
I can see you and hear you. There's a little bit of an echo.
Okay, there. Turn the echo off. Okay, yeah. I'm leaving my office and I'm going to go up to the living room. Okay. In the living room. And if you look behind
me. Oh, wow, there it is right there.
Hanging on the wall.
Fantastic.
You are leaving the American sector.
English, Russian, French, and German. Right. I'd forgotten the Russian was there as well. Right. Wow. Superb.
So that's really a one-of-a-kind piece. Now, let me take you down to the basement.
Okay.
And show you the other one. That one was pretty clean looking. I think they kept it nice and clean because it was at Checkpoint Charlie. And that was sort of like a tourist hotspot.
Yes.
But let me show you the other one. The other one is a little bit dirtier. One day when you come to LA, Peter, you're going to have to come and see them in person.
I would love to. I would love to.
Maybe one day one of these signs will end up in the lobby of the Hoover Institution. You never know.
They would love it. The archivist would love it.
Okay, so let's take a look.
Oh, there it is.
This is the real deal, Peter. These are not fakes.
You are, so what, that says something different though, doesn't it? You are carrying?
This is the side that says you are entering the American.
I see. Carrying and weapons.
It says you are entering the American sector. Carrying weapons be forbidden.
Wow, right.
Obey traffic rules. And it was also in four languages.
That one's bigger, actually, isn't it? Wider?
No, it's about the size.
It's about the same size? Okay. Fantastic.
But this one's all scratched up, you could see, for some reason. I think it was just the way. Yeah. These are just terrific people. They really are. Now, when you went to Berlin with Reagan, did you go to Checkpoint Charlie?
I did not go to Checkpoint Charlie. I went to the wall where he would speak, very close to the Reichstag, but I did not go to Checkpoint Charlie.
Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there has always been a museum at Checkpoint Charlie about the wall. Were you aware of that?
I have not visited it, but yes, I'm aware of it.
It's called House on Checkpoint Charlie, and it was run by a guy named Rainer Hildebrandt, who died. But he was the visionary behind the museum, and he always wanted to teach people about the history of the wall.
I'll visit that sooner or later, someday, one of these days.
You know, I view this period as an incredibly important time in history. And I fear that the memory of the lessons of this period are slowly being lost. And I wanted to get your thoughts about this, because the way I see it is that, you know, mankind had a really good chance to try out the ideas of communism, to try out the ideas of socialism. And they failed miserably. Mm. They tried it. It just didn't work. And I feel like these ideas are making a resurgence. You know, as Tom Sowell, you know, the way he frames it, he doesn't frame it in moralistic terms. He frames it in more economic terms about centralized control of the economy or versus a coordinated society like capitalism. And he talks in at length about the advantages of a price coordinated system versus a command economy. And that was tried. They tried it in Romania, in Bulgaria, in Russia, and in China. And to this day, they're still trying it in Cuba and North Korea. And and we won the Cold War, as Reagan said, we're gonna beat these guys. You told that story.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about all this? I mean, has the lesson of the Cold War been forgotten?
It has, by and large, it has. That that strikes me as one of the big questions of the time of the day today. The big questions for I have five kids from 31 down to 21. It's the big question that their generation is going to have to face. And the question is this: can democracies learn from the experience of previous generations, or do they only straighten up and do what they ought to do when the generation then running the country learns the lesson itself? That is to say, is the American Republic doomed to a pattern of catastrophe followed by recovery? Or can the lessons be incorporated into the national understanding of itself? I don't know the answer to that. I really just don't know the answer to that. I think of Milton Friedman. I had dinner with Milton. This may be about 18 months before he died. And we were chatting about his life and about the, and Milton looked at me and he said, the challenge for my generation, that is to say for my Milton Friedman's generation, the challenge for my generation was to develop an intellectual justification for human liberty. Now that's still Tom Sowell's generation. Tom is the last great member of the generation that beginning at mid-century produced this enormous, wonderful body of work on the importance of Friedman, Hayek, importance of freedom, Hayek, Milton Friedman, Gary Becker, Tom Sowell. And then Milton said, the question for your generation, pointing to me across the table, is whether you can keep your liberty. And I think my generation, our generation, I'm talking to you now, you and I were about, seem to be about the same age. We did it pretty well. We did do a pretty good job. And now we have a rising generation embracing wokeness. And wokeness is really just a short way of saying one group of people with one set of values gets to tell everybody else what they can say and think. And that is not liberty. So I just don't know the answer to that question, but it's the question. I think I know that much. That's the question now.
One of the things that struck me about your story about the Reagan speech in Berlin was that when you spoke to the, you know, people in the State Department and other so-called experts, they told you that the Germans had gotten used to the wall. You didn't need to mention it. In a way, it was like rubbing their nose in it. Just keep, you know, just talk about in generalities about freedom and things like that, but don't actually refer to the wall. And Reagan and you insisted on it. And you seem to have been proven right that when Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate, tear down this wall, you could just feel the emotion in the crowd that was there. You know, it actually gives me chills every time I listen to that speech because you felt the pent up emotion in those Germans listening to that speech. And they didn't get used to it.
That's
right.
They
were frustrated about it. And yes, they stopped talking about it. And I guess my question is, you know, what have we gotten used to? What has our generation gotten used to? You know, like I find it interesting, and I'd love your reflections on this. In my lifetime, I have been fascinated by two walls. The Berlin Wall. And then the wall that we don't have, that we were promised here at the southern border of our country. One wall was designed to keep people in.
Right.
The other wall was supposed to keep people out. Have we gotten used to not having a border?
It looks as though, well, have we gotten used to not having a border? I'm not, it's as far as I can tell, there's an element in the country that doesn't want a border. The Biden administration now, I don't want to become overtly partisan, but they keep talking about the situation at the border is under control. It's under, if you're president of the United States for 2 years and the border is still out of control, that's because that's what you want. He has the money, the resources. If he had wanted to reassert the rule of law at the border, he could have done so by now. So you have to suppose that this is the considered policy of one of our great parties, that either for reasons of ideology, they consider the people of Mexico oppressed and borders are wrong in and of themselves. And who are we? Our country is so flawed in the first place that who are we to decide who gets to live here and who doesn't? This sort of jumble of ideological reasons, or it could be a straightforward political calculation that recent experience demonstrates that when immigrants get to this country, they vote for one party and not the other for a generation or two. It could be a straightforward political calculation. First, we'll get them in. large numbers of people, then we'll figure out some way to normalize them and get them the vote, and they'll vote for us. So that does seem to be what one of the great political parties in this country is thinking. And the other political party, I don't think, has gotten used to it. It seems to me there's a big fight brewing, and it'll shape up in the presidential election of 2024. So that feels to me as though it's still a live issue. That feels to me the border is a live issue. It hasn't been for, I don't think that's one that we have gotten used to. I think that's still a fight, I think. But it's a fascinating question. When I read the other day, what was it, just a day or two ago, Governor DeSantis of Florida, it's an institution I had never heard of before, I have to confess, the New College of Florida, and it turns out to be a public institution. And Governor DeSantis named some new trustees, and they fired the president. There was a woke president of the institution, and they fired her. And I thought to myself, can they do that? But that is something that shows that I had gotten used to the idea. I had gotten used to the idea that academia is just permanently on the left, that in the last decade, the last 5 years in particular, academia has undergone a kind of woke revolution, and that's just the way it is. I had gotten used to it. I had been numbed into living with something that it's not clear that we really do need to live with. That got my attention, and I thought to myself, oh, that surprised me just because I had been taking for granted things that I didn't need to and that I shouldn't have. So I don't think the border is something we've gotten used to yet, but that notion that we can get used to living, we can make concessions in our own minds. We can make concessions and learn to live with them and say, there's nothing that can be done about that. Let's move on. That's a great danger in a democracy.
Yeah. I mean, Reagan had that vision where, you know, the experts of the time were just assuming that the Soviet empire was going to be around forever.
And exactly, we just
get used to it. And Reagan said, no, we're going to win and they're going to lose.
Exactly.
He accomplished that in just a few years, amazingly. And that's, you know,
and the point you make about what have we gotten used to? What kinds of concessions do we make? That's a very good example of it, because the foreign policy consensus was in both parties. It was Republicans as well as Democrats who said, well, no, the best we can hope for is detente. The Soviets are here to stay. The best we can hope for is to manage the relationship and wait. And Reagan, I was thinking about this the other day. I was talking to an Englishman. There's a parallel here. It may sound over dramatic, but I don't think it is, actually. There's a parallel between Reagan taking office and Churchill taking office in 1940. When Churchill became prime minister, now, the circumstances are less dramatic in the sense that Hitler was on the march, France had already fallen. It was a more dramatic situation in that sense. But when Reagan takes office, the Soviets have been on the advance for the decade of the 70s. And the Cold War was a war. They were gaining ground. We were losing ground. They believed in a totally different way of living from the way we believe. Power. So there was a lot at stake. All right. When Churchill takes office, Hitler is his second problem. His first problem is the British establishment. He can't operate. He can't wage the kind of war that he believes the country needs to wage without first changing the minds of his own people, and in particular of the British elite, the British establishment, which had convinced itself that appeasement was the only honorable and indeed the only possible course of action for them. So Churchill comes as an enormous shock to this establishment. But even as he's beginning to arm, to take on Hitler, he's giving speeches in the House of Commons. Hitler is always an audience. The Germans are always an audience. He's intending these speeches as well for the American public, that he wants to rally Americans behind Britain. But his first audience is seated right there in the House of Commons. He has to change the minds of his own people. Ronald Reagan takes office in January 1980, and he faces very much the same problem. What he's doing throughout much of the first term is addressing his own, the American people, and doing and changing the minds of that foreign policy establishment. Now, he was more successful in bringing along the American people than he was in bringing along the foreign policy establishment, as the story you just told demonstrates. As late as 1987, he'd been president for, he took office in, he's elected in 80, takes office in 81. So by 1987, he's been president for 6 years. And the Secretary of State and the Assistant Secretary of State for Eastern Europe and the Colin Powell was the Deputy National Security Advisor and the National Security Council staff all opposed the speech in which Ronald Reagan was going to say, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. No, 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 no. Don't do that. We don't want to put Gorbachev in an awkward position. Their thinking was still conditioned by détente, the notion of coexistence, and so forth. So just, I'm struck more and more as the years go by and I look back on that episode. I look back on it a lot because it was one of the most vivid moments of my life. I look back on that episode and I see that Reagan was remarkable in many ways, but one of his great accomplishments was persuading Americans themselves, carrying, and as I say, the establishment was slow to move, but he carried the American people with him. All right. That was a pretty remarkable thing. So what is in our minds, in the Berlin Wall speech and the closing, the president quotes a piece of graffiti on the Berlin Wall. And I had noticed it and made a note of it in my notebook a couple of months earlier when I went to Berlin to gather material. I thought it was very striking. And the president liked it too, so it stayed in the speech. And the graffiti, who knows who spray painted it on the wall? I don't know. It was in English, so I could understand it and made a note of it, put it in my notebook. This wall will fall. Beliefs become reality. And I have always thought that that put things in the right order. First, what do we believe? What do we think? What are our principles? What do we know to be true? Where do we stand? That comes first. And then reality adjusts itself. We start working on reality. Reality adjusts itself, but beliefs really are. Beliefs really do come first. That is the first, what we carry around in our heads is the first order reality.
You know, I was thinking about another president that had a similar vision and, you know, to shake up what we had gotten used to. And, you know, when I was a kid, a lot of things were made in America. I remember RCA, Zenith Televisions. Sure. You remember all these brands,
right? Of course.
But over the decades, everything moved to China and we just got used to it. We just got used to the fact that we don't make things anymore and no one questioned it. And I remember when Trump was running for president, he said, we can make things here. And I thought to myself, really? You know, it had just become something that I had just got.
That's exactly right. Yes, right. We thought of it, sort of became inevitable. We thought it felt inevitable. Nothing you could do about it. You just had to learn to live with it.
You know, American steel, American coal, America, you know, it just became. Now, the other thing you mentioned was how all the experts got it wrong about Reagan's speech. And now you work at the Hoover, you work at Stanford, you've met a lot of experts in your life. And one of Sowell's main themes, especially from his book, Intellectuals and Society, is that experts not only get it wrong much of the time, but they cause many of the disasters that we endure. You're nodding your head right now. Our listeners.
No, I'm nodding because this is one of the great themes. This is one of the great, what did I know? I was a kid from upstate New York, so I defer to these great foreign policy experts. And then what happened that day in Berlin was that I went to see the wall and thought, wow, this is a very striking fact of human existence. If you look over the wall, you see a very poor, drab city. And on the other side in West Berlin, you see a modern town where people are well-dressed and there's traffic. Whatever this wall divides, it divides between life and a kind of walking death. this is serious. This is a real thing here. I'm thinking this to myself. Then I go off and meet a guy called John Kornblum, who was the ranking American diplomat. And he was full of ideas about what Reagan shouldn't say. He said, you know, the people in West Berlin understand the need for nuance and subtlety in East-West relations. And he's the one who said, don't make a big deal about the wall. They've gotten used to it by now. Okay. And then that evening I went to a dinner party that was put on for me to enable me to meet some West Berliners. And I just said, is it true? Have you gotten used to the wall? There's a kind of silence. And then they started talking about it. And it was very clear to me. What did I know? I didn't know anything, but I had eyes, I had ears. And it was very clear to me that West Berliners may have stopped talking about the wall. But if you asked them, have you gotten used to it? The answer was, how could we get used to living like this? I just thought, wait a minute, I have a problem here. I have a highly trained, sophisticated diplomat who's telling me one thing, and then I go out and encounter reality, actual West Berliners, and they tell me something else. Who am I going to believe? My eyes. I'm going to believe my eyes. All right. So to me, that was just a shocking event. Tom comes to a similar conclusion. Tom's opening view is, you're an expert. You must not know very much. Or that's not quite right. You're an expert. You must be mistaken. So Tom told, this is a great Sowell line. I can't remember whether he said this on camera, and if so, what's on YouTube someplace, or whether this is something he just remarked to me off camera. But Tom holds an undergraduate degree from Harvard University. Pretty impressive. And Tom said, well, the main advantage of holding a Harvard degree is that for the rest of your life, you never have to feel intimidated by somebody who holds a Harvard degree. That's Tom. That's Tom. And his book, In the Vision of the Anointed, that's really what it comes down to. The subtle vanity or will to power that affects so much of academia and so often affects people who consider themselves expert. If I know more than everybody else, and of course I do, says the expert, then really, shouldn't I be running things? And that subtle voice in the back of their mind, even good people, all the incentives are to say, we should be in charge, not ordinary people. And it's subtle and constant and pernicious. And you end up becoming, in your own mind or in your professional activities, you start thinking of yourselves as members of an anointed or set apart class. And that's very pernicious. And then what Tom, of course, demonstrates in detail, it's one of the great themes of his life's work, is that once you begin thinking like an expert, like somebody who knows better, once you place yourself in that position of intellectual vanity, your ability to think clearly, to test your results against actual reality, somehow or other begins to erode. And in his book, Intellectuals, he presents this, it's irrefutable, that one great intellectual after another throughout history has been a jerk, lived a kind of life in which you wouldn't want to know this person, and has done damage in the policies that he or she has advocated. So there is this really peculiar, and as I say it again and again, it's one of the great things. I noticed it in, now that I've lived the life that I've lived, if you're dealing with somebody who's condescending toward you or toward anybody else, there's a problem. And I noticed this in Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman would pause to explain himself to anybody. A 19-year-old Stanford sophomore asks Dr. Friedman a question, and if it's a good question, Milton, it doesn't matter what the credentials, age, nothing matters except whether, is it a good question? I'll stop and answer it. And if it was a stupid question, it didn't matter if you were a fellow Nobel Prize winner. Milton would say that was a stupid question. He was no respecter of persons. He respected ideas. He was always alive to seriousness and honesty. I guess that's really what it comes down to. Tom Sowell and Milton Friedman had kind of built-in honesty detectors. Did people really mean to ask the question? Or another, I'm sorry, I'm yakking. I'm going on and on here, but I'm trying to get it. What makes Tom, Tom? What made Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan? What made Milton Friedman, Milton Friedman? After Milton died, Gary Becker, another Nobel Prize winning economist, another great man in his own right, Gary gave a eulogy in which he began by saying that when he was a student at the University of Chicago and he took a class from Milton Friedman, what struck him, Gary Becker, immediately was that Milton was different from so many other professors that he'd had, because for Milton, it wasn't a game. It wasn't a game. Economics was not about building models, publishing papers, winning the respect of a small group of professionals so that you could get offers from this, that, or the other university. Economics was about the way human beings lived. It was about the way people spent most of their lives, because most people spend most of their lives in the business of trying to support themselves. So I thought, that's it. That with Tom and with Milton, with Ronald Reagan too, this was not a game. Life was not a game. This was serious.
One of the facts that Thomas Sowell talks about that always stuck in my mind was that studies show that conservatives donate more blood than liberals. This might sound like a curiosity that you'd find in the Guinness Book of World Records or something, right, but it actually, when you really scratch your head and you think, how could that be? Because liberals have the image, the self-image of being the empathetic, the compassionate. But why is it that conservatives donate more blood? Why would they do that if they don't care about other people? And I think what Sowell's really saying is that if you really care about people, if you really, really, really care about the poor, the underprivileged, the humanity in general, then you would espouse more capitalistic, more conservative policies, because those have the proven track record of helping those people.
Correct.
Even though they don't sound good, there's no one you can point to as an angel and a villain, but they just work better.
Right. That's exactly, you know, speaking, right.
You mentioned the Nobel Prize winner. You know, one of my pet peeves is that we've gotten used to the Nobel Prize being some sort of gold standard credential. Why? Why isn't there a Thiel Prize?
Mm.
Or Peter, you and I need to speak with these people. They need to start their own competing prize, because we need to break the monopoly of this darned prize.
Yeah, which at this point, I mean, the Nobel Prize does go to some impressive people and has over the years, but you have to think to yourself, wait a minute, Yasser Arafat? I think that's not just disgraceful, that's a permanent disgrace. Barack Obama? Barack Obama's no Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat was a bad guy. Barack Obama's fundamentally a good guy, but to give him the Nobel Prize in the first months of his presidency before he's done anything, again, that shows a level of frivolity, unseriousness, from which I would argue it's just impossible to recover. You can't take that operation seriously ever since that.
Tom Sowell said on your program, and I've watched this clip many times, that Barack Obama was the worst president in U.S. history. And you were like, worse than Nixon? He's like, yes, worse than. And then you named a couple other presidents. He was like, yes, worse than those guys. And he got the Nobel Prize.
Right.
So, you know, one of the things that always strikes me is that this, you know, the track record of communism and socialism, and let's just call it a planned economy, a centralized economy, is so poor. And 90 miles from Florida is a prime example that any one of us can visit. I've been to Cuba.
Oh, Peter, have you? I never have.
If you haven't gone, you really should go while you still can, while it's still a communist society. Because, and everybody listening to this podcast should just get on a plane and go to Cuba and see for yourself what a centralized a central planned economy looks like in practice, instead of just reading books about it. It's right there for all to look at. I wanted to visit North Korea, but my wife would not let me. You know, given my history with pilfered historical objects, she was afraid that I would get arrested like Otto Warmbier did for stealing a flag. So, thank God for my wife.
By the way, while we're on Cuba, I haven't been to Cuba, but I haven't been to Cuba for what strikes me as a pretty good reason. I'm married to a Cuban, and her father, my wife was actually born in this country just after her parents left Cuba. They left in 1959 when Fidel took over. And it took my father-in-law 3 months to figure out this was not going to work out well and to get his family out of the country into this country. So I pay attention to Cuba. He died just over a year ago, but he wanted the children to become American, and he wanted to ensure that his children never displayed an exile mentality. So he didn't want them to go back. So honoring her own father, my wife is always, now he's gone now and it's not the same. We may go back sooner or later. In any event though, never having been there, I've still paid attention to Cuba. And I have something to suggest for you and for those listening to us. Watch Our Man in Havana, a 1959 movie. It's a wonderful movie, a kind of a dark comedy. Alec Guinness plays the lead. Noel Coward plays a role. Ernie Kovacs, remember the great old comedian Ernie Kovacs? But here's what's striking about Our Man in Havana. It was shot on location in Cuba in 1959, just a few months before Fidel arrived before the revolution succeeded and Fidel took Havana. So you can see street scenes. You can get a pretty good feel for what Havana looked like before the revolution. And then you can go to YouTube or Google and type in pictures of Havana, and you'll see the same buildings, but they're crumbling. You'll see the same automobiles, and I don't mean similar automobiles. I mean the same automobiles as were on the streets in 1959. And you just think, how heartbreaking, because Havana, no doubt there were problems with Cuba in the old days, but it was a prosperous, beautiful city. Cuba was an island in which, again, there was real poverty. Where wasn't there poverty in Latin America? But there was a kind of openness, trade between the United States, Cuba, Cubans selling sugar and tobacco and other products, other agricultural products around the world. Cuba was on the rise in those days. A communist revolution takes place and it stops. The progress just stops. So those buildings are still there, but now they're crumbling because they haven't been maintained in 6 decades. It's heartbreaking, but it's a very good before and after picture. Our Man in Havana, which is enjoyable in and of itself, I think it's on Netflix, is the before picture. And then look at any picture you can find online of Havana today, and that's after. And as you have noted a couple of times, it can't be said too often. The results of the experiment are in. We know that communism doesn't work.
You know, I've been to South Korea, and I went to Panmunjom, which is the militarized zone between South and North. And I was at that exact spot where Trump shook hands with Kim Jong-un. And I'll never forget that moment when he stepped over the line. I really got chills just watching that. I really thought they were going to grab him and never let him go, you know? How did you feel when you saw that? Was that like a revolutionary moment in East-West history, that stepping across the line?
I'd have felt, but honestly, I have to admit that one, I thought, okay, now we'll see what happens next. And the answer is not much happened. It's better to be talking to them than to be fighting them. As far as I can tell, the real action in Korea is still in South Korea, which has elected a genuine conservative as president now, so who's making free market reforms. That's the real action. I was all in favor of President Trump opening negotiations and trying to bust that logjam with North Korea. as far as I can tell, not much ever came of it, unfortunately.
You know, I have this theory that really what we need to do is give the North Koreans a way to save face in liberalizing their economy, you know, without having to admit that they were wrong all those decades, but to somehow welcome them into the family of nations. And, you know, I was really hopeful that Kim Jong-un, a man who had studied in Switzerland, if I'm not mistaken, so he knew what a Western supermarket looked like. You know, he knew he wasn't completely sheltered. And I was, you know, I had had hopes that he would have been the one that could turn that society around. I don't know. Maybe I'm a pie in the sky optimist.
Well, it ain't over yet. We'll see.
So, you know, I hear rumors that Tom Sowell is about to release a new book. It's on Amazon. It's called Social Justice Fallacies. Do you have him slated for an interview about that book?
I have my request in.
Okay.
I have not yet heard back. I hear from Tom when Tom is good and ready. And I have not yet heard back from him. But I saw that just someone else pointed it out to me. Look, there's something. I checked with Tom's office and they said, yes, actually, he's got another book coming out. And so I sent a note to him and I'm waiting to hear.
Great. So, you know, one of the things I heard, Victor Davis Hanson said that most of the money that comes into the Hoover Institution comes in the name of Thomas Sowell. And I was just wondering if that was true. I mean, it just seems like an extraordinary fact that one man could generate so many donations. Do you know anything about that?
A lot of money comes in. A lot of money comes in. I'd be surprised if it was anything like majority of money coming in.
Okay.
Our director, our esteemed director, Condi Rice, is doing a pretty good job of, as a matter of fact, she's doing a spectacular job of fundraising to enable the Hoover Institution to grow and pursue other projects and so forth. But I know of some multi-million dollar gifts in particular that came in because of Tom Sowell. I doubt that it's a majority, but I don't know. I just plain don't know.
Now I hear a rumor that you are also working on a book about the Cold War, Berlin. Tell us a little more if you can, if it's not.
Well, I'll tell you a little more, but only a little bit, because I have discovered that God gives me a choice every day. I can talk about a book or I can work on it. And there is some weird thing. I don't know if you discover this, Alan, but somehow if I talk about a project, my writing is just, the energy is gone for the day. So I won't tell you much about it. It's just that as I mentioned, Ronald Reagan spoke in Berlin on June 12th, 1987 for about 18 minutes. And because I was right in the middle of that event, because I was the speechwriter assigned to that draft, it was one of the most vivid passages in my life. I went to Berlin to research it. I wrote the draft and then talked it over with Ronald Reagan. And then for 3 weeks, the State Department and the National Security Council fought the speech. Those are pretty momentous 3 weeks. I was 29 at the beginning and I had just turned 30 when the president delivered the speech. So I've been thinking about that speech for all these years. What was the fight over? How could they have opposed that? And then I think to myself, wait a minute, if I were to tell the story of that speech to my own kids, I'd have to tell them what the Berlin Wall was. They don't remember that anymore. What was the Berlin Wall? Who built it in the first place? What were they trying to accomplish? Wait a minute. They built that wall to keep people in their own countries? Yes, they did. And why was it still standing 26 years later when President Reagan visited? All right. So the idea of this book is pretty simple. It's the story of one speech and what I think I've learned about what it meant, what it tells us about the Cold War, what it told us about Ronald Reagan, about the nature of this country, about communism versus liberty. So the notion I have is, I'll just call the book Tear Down This Wall, the speech that almost wasn't, and tell the story and do so in the way, in say 10 lessons for my kids, for the next generation, what they ought to know about that one speech. I think that telling that one, on the one hand, it's insignificant. It was just 18 minutes. All anybody remembers about it is four words, tear down this wall, just let it go. But I think, oh no, actually, people do still remember it. And now we've got a generation of kids coming up who would like to know why people remember it. What did that mean? And that's what I'd like to write. I'm working on a book about just that, just to tell the story and what reflecting on that story for all these years, the lessons I think that that speech gives us.
One of the most popular t-shirts that we had at my shop, by the way, my shop in Berlin was called After the Fall.
Oh, and, nice.
And the logo looked like the Berlin Wall. And one of the most popular shirts that I had was a drawing of the wall in black and white pencil. And it had the slogan under it. And the wall was open. It was broken in the middle. And the slogan said, "The future isn't what it used to be."
Oh, that's nice. That's very nice. That's very nice.
And it reminded me of when Reagan said those words, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." In that moment, it was an inflection point. The future isn't what it used to be. And that's, I think, what the message of your book is, that courageous words and actions can completely change the future.
Mm-hmm. I have come to think that. For years, I wondered, what difference did it really make? I talked about it a couple of times with Mikhail Gorbachev, who said, made no difference at all. That made no difference to us in Moscow. We knew Ronald Reagan was an actor. He needed colorful lines. That's all it was. It was just a piece of theater. And I was willing to accept that. What do I know? And then maybe beginning 10 years or so ago, I began meeting people who had lived in Eastern Europe and in particular in East Germany at the time that Reagan gave the speech. And you have to hear this from West Germans don't care to be reminded of this. For reasons you'd understand, they're very proud people. And the idea that an American president comes and gives a speech, and I think the Cold War was not a happy experience for West Germans because, well, imagine the future of your country gets decided each day in Moscow and Washington, not in your own country. That was the German position throughout the Cold War. Okay. But East Germans will say, what I've heard over and over again over the years is, I couldn't believe that an American president would say that. That sense to them that at first it felt unreal because, and this goes directly back to what you raised earlier, what can we get used to? They'd gotten used to the wall. They had begun to think of it as permanent. And suddenly an American president says, tear down this wall. And immediately they have a new thought. There's a new sense of a new kind of space for possibility. Wait a minute. What about that? What about if that wall weren't there? And I have come to the conclusion that the speech did matter because, once again, human beings matter. What we think, our imaginations matter. And he touched on people's moral imagination. They suddenly began, maybe it was a question of hope. Suddenly there was a new hope. Maybe there could be a world without that wall. Anyway, that's what a lot of people have told me over the years. So I've come to the conclusion that it did have an effect. Maybe not on Mikhail Gorbachev, but it turns out in the end, his country doesn't even exist and ours still does. So I think we did win and they did lose. And it was because of the ordinary people, not the experts, the ordinary people who heard that speech and thought at some level, yes, maybe.
Peter Robinson, thank you for joining me on the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Alan, a pleasure. Do you still have any of these t-shirts?
Unfortunately, I don't. They're all gone. I don't even have any pictures.
I'm doing this whole podcast just in the hope of getting a free t-shirt out of it, for goodness sake. All right. Thanks so much. A pleasure.
Thanks, Peter.
I hope we get to meet at some point.
Me too.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
I follow the Moscow and down to Gorky Park, listening to the wind of change. August summer night, soldiers passing by, listening to the wind of change. Ladies and gentlemen, can you welcome please Mr. Morten Harket.
If you get value out of this podcast, please consider supporting our work on Patreon at patreon.com/soulgenius. Whatever you can give helps in many ways to popularize the books and ideas of You Know Who. I'm Alan Wolin, and this has been episode 30 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. Thanks for listening.
Take me to the magic of the moment on a globe.